Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. With me today, as always, is Susan Arthur. And this week, we decided that we would take some questions that we presented to you on a previous show. We invited you to call in and give us your questions on recording, and we'll select the ones that we think might be of most interest to our listeners as well as helpful to you. So with that, I turn it over to Susan Arthur to tell us what we're going to talk about today.
Well, we did get a lot of responses from you, and some of you have some really good questions. You're dealing with a lot of different things. Our first one is an email, though. She kind of decided to send us an email instead, and I think you're going to love this. She says, okay, at age 70 years old, while vacationing with my kids and grandkids, I decided to go parasailing. I know I'm crazy, but it sounded like fun at the time. Well, unfortunately, I was not placed in the harness correctly and suffered a debilitating injury to my legs. I have recovered somewhat, but will never be quite the same, and have recently received a settlement from the parasailing company. I anticipate needing to have some money available for ongoing and future medical expenses. So what's next? Thanks, Joe.
Well,
I'm excited about the 70-year-old parasailing.
Yeah, you have to respect that spirit.
That's what I was thinking. I thought, good for her.
Yeah, and you know, and the fact that it occurred apparently somewhere where there was insurance or at least an ability to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Often people do these sorts of extraordinary things when they're at extraordinary places.
Out of the country?
Yeah, they'll often be in the Caribbean or mm-hmm. somewhere, and many of those companies often have no insurance. Sometimes they're not even incorporated, so you have the issue of a foreign entity that you have to have a judgment transferred from one country to another. So it's difficult. So in this case, apparently there was a settlement, and we hope that this lady recovers very quickly from this. I think she suspects there may be some residual problems.
Mm-hmm.
So she got a sufficiently large sum to where she wants to figure out how can I best preserve it.
Right.
And protect it for these future costs.
Well, and at 70, she's probably retired as well and not working full time anymore. So she's probably got to look at all of that as well. So that's lot to juggle.
And so we'll speculate about some of the details since we don't know the full story. I would bet that among the concerns is that there may be other long-term care costs that could quickly consume this, or it could affect qualification for long-term care. So rather than treat this as simply a question about, you know, where do I place this money in terms of investment return, which is, you know, probably you should submit to a financial planner more than the lawyer. But I think the question she's submitting to us is, you know, how do I structure this and where do I place it so it'll be preserved from other things that might be coming down the pike?
Mm-hmm.
And among those would foreseeably be long-term care costs. So in that case, this is an asset that would be considered. And to the extent that you divert it, even before you actually have it, the rules are so strict in terms of qualification for long-term care through, for example, Medicaid, that even if you redirect it, it still is treated as if you had control of it, and it counts against you for what many listeners are familiar with, this look-back period.
Mm-hmm.
And those who are not, I won't go into detail except to say that in order to qualify for Medicaid, often people will kind of move assets around some so they can be eligible. And that their goal is to preserve, you know, what is a relatively small amount of money, but still it's all they have for their children and for their grandchildren. But in moving those assets around, they have to be very careful because there's a 60-month look back, and anything that's transferred gratuitously is the word. Anything that's transferred in a way for which there's not a replacement asset in your portfolio, so to speak, is going to be regarded as a violation, and it incurs a penalty. And there's a penalty period.
And 60 months, I mean, that's 5 years.
That's a long time.
That's a long time.
And while it's not so daunting to people who are in comparatively good health. I was meeting with a couple yesterday, and I regularly meet with such couples who they're over 70, but they regard themselves as being in pretty good health, mm-hmm. and they think it's very realistic for them to commence a plan which would be based upon their being healthy for the next 5 years. So for them that seems like a very reasonable expectation. Never a guarantee, but very reasonable. And so for people like that to do such planning, of course it makes sense. And in this case, the thing about money coming in like that is suddenly somebody who might otherwise have been eligible
right.
in short order perhaps, now maybe not eligible until all that money is soaked up for a purpose that doesn't relate to this particular injury.
Right.
Instead, it relates to sort of maintenance care, because often that's what long-term care is. Because if it's purely medical and it's medical for purposes of curing an illness or for treating a disease, fixing an injury, those are things that Medicare is for, and Medicare will cover people who are over 65 and have those problems. However, for those other things that come with old age, and they relate to a more general custodial / medical maintenance care.
Chronic,
yeah. There's a medical component, but it often requires a facility.
Mm-hmm.
And for those people, you know, the rules for Medicaid to come in and help with that are pretty strict. So normally the money coming in like we're talking about here, let's throw a number at it. Let's say it was $200,000. If it were that much money, then it means waiting for, let's do the math, of approximately 40 months. If you assume a penalty period, which in Missouri it's close to $5,000 per month. Mm-hmm. So to help you understand as listeners, if you take $200,000 and give it away to a relative, for example, or even put it in a trust, then there's going to be this 40-month penalty period.
Hmm.
So the effect of that is to require you to spend that money, recover it and spend it as they think you should have, or either way you incur the loss of coverage for that period of time that you're otherwise eligible to be in the institution. So this subject is complicated, but I think that the best thing in this case, hopefully this lady is otherwise expects to make it for a period of time. And if she does, then it makes a lot of sense for her to perhaps create a trust and let the sand start going through the hourglass on that so mm-hmm. that she knows that soon she'll qualify. There are various other steps. I don't want to represent to our listeners that this is really the only means, is you're up against this 60-month wall and you've got to go over that particular wall in order to get coverage. That's not true. There are various exceptions, qualifications, exclusions, et cetera, to where there's a toolbox of options that are available. But it does mean planning for that. And the simplest item in the toolbox, the sort of safe harbor, is for somebody who's otherwise reasonably healthy and doesn't expect to go into any specialized care facility for 60 months or so. For them, the easy call would be this. And in this case, I suspect that would be probably one of the primary concerns for somebody who's 70 and over.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I'm sure that's really helpful information for her today. Now, we have another question from Craig. And Craig has a question. He's power of attorney, but he has a question about debt.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a relative who I am power of attorney of, and they are incurring quite amount of debt with credit cards, second mortgages, car loans. What, if anything, do I need to do to protect myself from incurring any of that debt?
Okay. Well,
we did talk to him just for a little bit more information. This is one of his parents is
okay.
the one who's incurring the debt. So he is her power of attorney or their power of attorney, and he doesn't want to get caught.
And a lot of people who accept a power of attorney worry about this, and it's not completely unfounded. I mean, the idea is that often your name, if you're the agent under this power, with a power of attorney, you have a principal and an agent, and the person who you ask to act on your behalf is your agent, and you are the principal. So let's assume that we're in the shoes of the agent, as this young man is. So I think that It is worth being careful, because it's your name that is appearing on documents on behalf of this person. So while Well, you do act under this power of attorney. You know that. And perhaps the person in front of you in whatever financial institution or whatnot might know that. But you wonder, do the other 2,000 or 3,000 people in that organization, not to mention related third parties, all know that? And so it is important that when you hold this power that you indicate in a signature block that that is your intention. You're signing as a holder of a power of attorney. That at least makes it crystal clear to anybody looking at that document later. It's like the concept is similar to someone who signs as an officer of a corporation. If you form a corporation, and some of our listeners I know have formed little, they may be very small corporations, but something to do business with for protection from liability, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So unless you indicate in a signature block, or unless it's already indicated, sometimes you will, for example, if you go in for a loan, it'll be typed overhead, the name of the entity, you know, comma LLC or Inc. Incorporated, and then below it, it'll say at president, and it'll indicate there in typing that this signature is someone who's an officer. So in that case, if you sign just your signature, clearly you're signing a signature block that says the person who's signing is an officer of a corporation. But absent that, often other things you sign very routinely will not have that sort of preparation. And so you'd have to indicate it's up to you to make clear that the form in which you're signing is in this capacity as a agent for this person. There are several ways in which that can be done so that it's clear that you're not signing individually. But in the absence of that, in fairness, I mean, think about it. If someone goes into a nursing home, and that's where litigation has come up in this area around the country in more than one case, well, often when they're admitting a family member who's a holder of a power of attorney, they're admitting the loved one, the principal, into this facility. So they're asked to sign documents. Somebody has to sign documents. Mm-hmm. And obviously the person who's horizontal is not in a position to do that. And even if they were, if they're not competent, the signature doesn't mean anything. So at that point, if you have a power of attorney, you're going to be asked to sign numerous forms and whatnot. So you want to make it crystal clear that the way in which you're signing is as a holder of a power of attorney. In other words, you're signing only on behalf of this other person, not on your individual capacity. But in the absence of that, and that this has happened more than once, you have loved ones who they're admitting someone, and yes, they told the facility they have a power of attorney, so the facility says, yes, we'll let you sign. But whether it's deviously or not, the facility seems to later recall that they asked the loved one to sign on behalf of themselves, and which is not a crazy thing to happen. Sometimes when you're borrowing money or you're engaging in expensive transactions, and this is an expensive transaction, mm-hmm. it's not unusual to ask someone else to sign on behalf of the person receiving the services. So then there becomes a he said, she said, and it happens because it was not clear on the document. And people just don't know. And so nursing homes are in a position to take advantage of that and to create an ambiguity at least later. And incidentally, sometimes family members have lost these cases. Now, of course, the winning side would argue that the reason they lost was they, in fact, did ask them to sign as individuals. They knew what they were doing, and they did. But all of us might be a little skeptical about that.
And so by signing as an individual, they obligate themselves to the financial aspect of that as well?
Yeah, they become a guarantor.
Okay.
So while there might still be the obligation perhaps first to go to the other person as the recipient of the services, perhaps not under a contract theory, but under restitution or something such as that, but still, they will have a cause of action, whether it's a primary cause, meaning they can sue them first, mm-hmm. or it's a secondary cause, a person is a guarantor.
And well, and you know, we've all been in this situation where you're in the midst of a crisis. I mean, and moving mom to a facility is going to be somewhat traumatic or a crisis, and you're just going to sign. They shove all these papers
whatever
in front
you put
of
under
you.
Me,
they
yeah.
start to do it, and you just sign away and go, okay, we got it admitted, and we got to do this, and we got to do that, and we got to do that. And I just see how that is so easy. That could be so easily happening.
And that's the reason, thankfully, courts are a little reluctant to take, you know, a coldly legal view when they see just that signature. They'll often want a few more facts. But I'll tell you that the answer on a law school exam, you know, that the law is clear that somebody who signs with their signature with no indication anywhere on the document that they intended to do anything but commit themselves And especially when they do have motivation to commit themselves, meaning it's not as if they're a company that would have not reasonably intended to do this.
Okay.
Family members, if in fact they did say, look, we're only going to take your mom if you personally do
right.
this. And occasionally, incidentally, that happens. But before I talk for a moment about that, I just want people to understand how this can end up to where there's liability is because you have all the ingredients. You have somebody who maybe if they thought it was the only way that they could get their mom in, they would have signed mm-hmm. individually, mm-hmm. even though in that case they didn't intend to. So that's the reason these cases have made their ways through the courts. But let me suggest this. When someone is a family member is put to it that they're supposed to or they're asked to supply some guarantor or some sign in some personal capacity, you know, I think that if they generally stick with the position and put in the signature block as they intend and don't argue the case at that time, often those things just go through rather than confront the issue for a facility that for whatever reason, and this is not routine, incidentally, but occasionally there in the cases you can see that clearly it happens where the facility says to this person, you know, I need some sort of assurance that this money's going to be coming. And those are often situations where maybe there's not the money on the front end, but there's been an application submitted for Medicaid coverage or at least someone says the application's been. So there's some doubt mm-hmm. on the part of the institution in fairness that they're going to ever be paid. So under those, when you look at the cases that have come down the pike, and not just in Missouri, but in other states as well, then often involves something like that. So in that case, yeah, the person should stick with the position that they're going to sign as a holder. Often if they don't argue the case and just sign it, then the admission is completed and the matter moves on. Usually it's best not to make a crisis out of the matter because then you force the other side to perhaps contact their lawyers.
Right. And so would it be something as simple as just saying, writing your signature and just handwriting on their power of attorney?
Yes, right
so
where your signature
is. It's really simple. So yeah. You don't have to go supply any document or anything.
Yeah, you would say as power of attorney for, and you put the name of the person.
Okay.
And then
your name, the name of the person.
And another way to do it is sign the name of the person and then say, and then sign your name as holder of power of attorney below that.
Okay.
The magic, what has to be there is that you're indicating that you are holding the power of attorney and you're signing on behalf of someone else.
Okay, simple. Really great advice today, Joe. All right, we have a question, one about a medical issue. And we've also talked to this person, too. But this one has a couple of issues with his parents.
Both of my parents are sick and have done very little to prepare for this time in their lives. What should my brother and I do to prepare for the time when they're no longer able to make financial and medical decisions for themselves?
Okay, so we talked to this person. He's got parents that we just needed a little bit more information. He's got parents that are both sick, and it's he and his brother who are in town, and the parents are sick, and they have not really done a lot of the things that they need to do it. His mother's facing a cancer diagnosis, and father is in an assisted living at the moment. So they're kind of in that situation where they're both aging, but they have not really prepared for anything long term, and mother has handled most of the issue. So now it's falling on the brothers, on the kids.
So this does raise an issue about, on the one hand, there are lots of bills out there, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, you want to try to have fewer of those as you get older. But look, the reality is, I know life goes on. And maybe in fairness to these parents, they may have had income that was very low and just to meet some of their important needs, they may have incurred these. We don't know the full story,
mm-hmm.
but we do know that apparently they have incurred these debts. He said second mortgages, plural. It sounded
perhaps,
like.
Yeah.
So anyway, the point is when you get in this position, you have to wonder how do you possibly get any sort of medical care when you're showing this sort of thing on a credit report or whatnot. Well, the good news is, a couple like this is probably a candidate for Medicaid coverage. That's not guaranteed. We'd need to know more, but it sounds like it. So we talked a few moments ago about the issues of holding a power of attorney and what the implications may be for that. And it sounds like in this case, he has a power of attorney.
Yeah, I think so.
Tying this in, though, with the previous question, I'm curious if there's a power of attorney. So one thing that we would want to know is if both parents are competent. Now, remember, in order to have a power of attorney in place and to be able to help them with the financial matters and legal matters, they have to be competent to sign it. So we know mom and dad are living. Dad's in an assisted care facility.
Assisted, but not long-term. I mean, just kind of like an assisted retirement home.
So he's probably competent.
Right.
And we suspect mom is competent.
Right.
So if they're both competent, then they can sign powers of attorney. At least that will empower one or both of these children. You can do a power of attorney and name both your children. And if they get along, it's not necessarily a bad idea, so you have somebody nearby. But in this case, I think one of the first things they ought to do is maybe get this authority. And as we talked about a few moments ago, it's not a risk to them as long as they're very meticulous in the way in which they sign documents, et cetera, for their parents. Now, you know, you don't even want to think about any sort of Chapter 7 bankruptcy. But in fairness, if my job as a lawyer is to list the range of possibilities, and this couple had income that was very low, as well as assets that are pretty low, then they may very well be candidates for that. I'm not a big advocate of that, but you know, if it meets needs of someone who are in this situation where there's no hope of financial recovery, then I think it may make sense. But I think one of the important things to do at the outset is to get some control over the behavior or the expenses that have been incurred. And we don't know a lot there, but sometimes it's a matter of kind of getting control of the checkbook. And you want to do that delicately and respectfully, but at times, you know, the parents, especially when they have children that are fortunate to have children such as these who are standing ready to help them, you know, they really need to avail themselves of that. And it often is helpful for the kids to, you know, to step forward and strongly encourage them to let them manage these. That's the starting point, because otherwise things just get worse. If you stand by and watch, even as a son or daughter, then it just becomes more frustrating.
So by declaring Chapter 7 or Chapter 11 or all of the different levels, I'm not sure, but does that then alleviate some of the pressure of this? It allows them to get Medicare or Medicaid, and then they can move on with their medical expenses and the treatments that they need. Is it that
yeah.
simple?
Yeah, it would eradicate any debt that they have out there. And there are a few things that don't get some priority debts that may not be fully discharged.
Has to be done or no?
Well, no, that's a Chapter 13.
Okay.
The Chapter 13 is what we call a repayment plan over typically 5 years or so, sometimes less. Their money is repaid, not 100 cents on the dollar, but a goal is some portion on the dollar. And a traditional bankruptcy is a Chapter 7, and that's when essentially someone places all their assets on the table, so to speak, and says, here, take these, and in exchange, I want all my debts forgiven. Now, that's an oversimplification because some assets are protected, equity in a house up to a certain point, and that number changes. I'm not a bankruptcy lawyer, but I'm thinking in Missouri, it's probably in the neighborhood of 10,000 or so now. It's pretty low, actually, the equity that's protected. So you have certain things that are protected, so you don't literally lose every asset. But it's not out of the question that somebody in this position might consider that. Now, it won't be – having these debts will not be an obstacle to their qualifying for Medicaid. Medicaid looks less at debts than at assets. So if they have a lot of assets in addition to a lot of debt, then in that case, the assets are the problem, not the debt.
Okay.
So it might make sense to pay off the debt. If, in fact, they have the ability to do it, as opposed to bankruptcy, they have the ability to pay it off with those assets, and they achieve two goals. They get rid of this debt that's hanging over them, as well as getting themselves qualified for Medicaid coverage.
Would you recommend selling some of your assets? I mean, selling your home, selling your car, that type of thing, in order to qualify for Medicaid?
If it's for purposes of paying off debts, then you can do that because that's not a gratuitous transfer.
Okay.
So it kind of serves two ends. If you know that you're going to lose the assets in qualifying for Medicaid because you have too many assets, then it makes sense to go ahead and use those assets to pay for debts, et cetera, which is a legitimate use. There's no penalty for that transfer. Then you've done two things. You've gotten rid of this debt and you've qualified yourself for Medicaid.
And even if you have the assets and owe a lot of money on them, you really don't own them. They don't really look at that debt portion of it. They look really more just at the assets. You have a house, a car,
that's right.
A vacation car, vacation home, something like that.
That's correct. If there's a mortgage on a house, like if you own a $200,000 house and you have a $190,000 mortgage, in qualifying for Medicaid, that will not be counted as a $200,000 asset. I mean, the asset portion is the $10,000 or so.
Okay. Okay. Well, that makes a lot more sense. Well, and that also kind of leads us to another issue that we really kind of wanted to talk about today. There's some new information from AARP about long-term care. And a lot of this that we've talked about involves long-term care. And it's one of those expenses that it just snowballs.
It does.
I mean, what do we do?
Well, you're right. I mean, it is a kind of the elephant in the room when mm-hmm. people are talking about whether or not to plan on preserving assets or for their cost of long-term care, or do they transfer them and hope to make it 5 years, or do they buy insurance? And the insurance, though, the price of it is just daunting to a lot of people.
Okay, you have to listen to this. I am looking at the AARP website talking about long-term care, and here's you're going to die. All right, so the cheapest state for the median annual cost for nursing home care is Texas.
That doesn't surprise me so much.
Yeah,
but go ahead.
At $54,800 per year.
$54,000.
That's the median annual cost. Annual cost. So that's per year. All right. The most expensive state is Connecticut at $150,200 for 1 year of nursing home care. Your average for the United States is $85,800, so that would probably be us. That may be about us.
Yeah, probably.
I've heard anywhere between $7,000 and $10,000a month.
I think that would be reasonable.
All right, and so for Alaska, if you have any friends in Alaska, here's what they're looking at. They didn't even include this in their statistics, but $292,000 per year.
Wow.
For nursing home care. That is crazy. Do you see why we're all going, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? And the average, I mean, less than 48% are spending, or 48% are spending a year. So that's 48% of the people are spending a year.
Those are not bad odds for
people
who
not.
Are figuring that. But it's the sort of thing you hate to bet on your leaving the world in just a year and consider that a victory.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But 13% are going to spend 5 years in a nursing home, in a long-term care facility. So that's still a lot.
It's a significant percentage.
That's a significant percentage and a lot of money that can wipe you out financially in a short amount of time.
And the stakes are so high, people hate to simply play the odds.
Right.
And no one likes to bet for an outcome that they wouldn't consider desirable.
Right.
And they hate to place their bets on that. There's something in us to where we want to plan for the hopeful alternative and be prepared for the worst. But in this case, financially, the best case scenario is you probably pass, because most of these people, let's assume, are not going home. Some may be, in fairness to this statistic. So we hear that 48% is going to be less than a year or less than a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Then those people, some portion will be going home. But we have to assume that another substantial majority has got to be probably passing during this period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So you just don't want a plan that's predicated on that, I don't think. Now if that is at the very end after a long life, well, okay, so be it. Then it's not so troubling. So then let's think about this for a minute. So the subject of long-term care insurance,
mm-hmm.
that comes up virtually every day in our practice, and I'm sure in any estate planner's practice, certainly any elder law lawyer's practice. And I think that it's right now a little foggy as to what the best strategy is, and you're going to get different opinions from different elder lawyers and people who are authoritative in this area. And, of course, you have to have some reservations about the insurance guys who admitted, I concede, they maybe know the most about the details of the industry, but they have a vested interest. They have a vested interest, of course, in a sale. And I don't mean to indict them, but you just have to assume that where there's money involved, it's going to affect judgment. And I think that some people decide that they're going to play the odds. Those people who are more risk-prone as opposed to risk-averse. Mm-hmm. And then others, though, that are very risk-averse, maybe they have a significant estate that they're determined that they want to help their children and grandchildren. So for them, they're preparing. They're willing to live with the possibility that they will have paid a lot of premiums someday and perhaps have never gone into a nursing home or only have gone into a nursing home for this 48% period mm-hmm. of a year or so. So these people, you know, are comfortable with that because they're like the people who buy fire insurance and housing insurance and all the other insurance in our life. We don't complain when we haven't used it fully. Often we take it as kind of a cost of, for lack of a better phrase, a cost of living or cost of doing business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, here's an interesting thing is that the average premium for long-term care insurance, you were talking about people are willing to pay it, mm-hmm. is $2,700 a year. So you do have to weigh it. So $2,700 a year for lots of years that you may not need it compared to the one that you might.
Yeah, and I'd like to know the details of how it's calculated. And while I don't question that it's probably correct, it's still assuming, I'll bet, a pretty long period so that you start pretty young. So you start out with early payments that are very low.
Probably.
And then you end up with, you know, significantly higher payments as you get older. And that average turns out to be this number, this $2,000 plus per year. But some people are listening or thinking, well, wait now. I talked to my agent, and I was told $1,000 a month. And people in their 60s may have been told that.
Mm-hmm. Well, but if you look, the latest statistic I saw, too, is that for every year over 65, if you get a policy at 64, or you are thinking about it at 64 and get a price, and then at 65 you decide to do it, you're going to pay 8 to 10% more just for waiting that 1 year.
And that sounds right. Now, think about that to our listeners. You know, you figure that the cost is going up with each year you wait, and maybe that 8 to 10% or so is going to be throughout the entire period of the policy. But I suspect that those percentages go up significantly with each year. So mm-hmm. I'd be willing to bet, we don't have these numbers in front of us, but I bet the price between 68 and 69, if it's 8% at 64 to 65, then it's probably 11 or 12, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm again looking at the AARP website. They're talking about it. So they say the combined annual premium for a 55-year-old couple is $2,100 for 55. If you go wait till 65, it's $3,700. So it's jumped again.
That's a big jump.
Mm-hmm.
So people have to weigh that, and for some people, incidentally, this isn't an option. In other words, if your health is in a certain condition, in other words, if you can't qualify, then this isn't an option. Whatever the price of the premiums are, as a practical matter, they're not going to take you. Mm-hmm. Their policies just say certain things are deal killers, and their actuaries have drawn some lines in the sand for the salespeople. And so I think that those, though, who do have the option, the question becomes, do you buy it, if at all, number one? And if the answer is, under some conditions, yes, then the next question becomes, you know, at what age mm-hmm. should you consider it, and what should the terms be? Used to, this was a simple discussion. Those who bought in the 90s sometimes, incidentally, got very good deals because the actuaries didn't know how to price the value of the product. And what's happened since then, of course, is the cost of medical care has gone up dramatically. Mm-hmm. And let me hurry to add, this is not simply inflation. It's also the appearance of new products, new mm-hmm. technology. So it's not an old thing getting more expensive. That's happened too. But also what's come down the pipe are solutions that, quite frankly, didn't even have a category.
Well, MRIs and CAT scans and some of these other things were not commonplace a few years ago.
Yeah. And there's other long-term care procedures mm-hmm. that can preserve life and functionality, new medications. So now then these insurance companies that created these premiums that were not realistic are struggling with what to do. And a recent Wall Street Journal article has pointed out that several of these major companies are in trouble and that they may not be able to survive this, the fact that they sold so many of these policies and they have these obligations now that they didn't have before. While they still have the right under most of these policies to do increases, there are certain limits to the amount of the increases, and they have to be increases across the board for holders of every product, everyone holding the product. So So it does produce a ceiling on the extent to which they can recover these additional costs. So it is a problem if you're one of these insurance companies. It's also a problem if you're one of these holders. There's not a federal agency that insures this. There's not an FDIC for people who buy long-term care insurance and the company goes under. Now, there may be some recourse against the company or officers or some other target, but as a practical matter, there's a good chance you'll never get this money.
Now, do a lot of these policies have limits? You know, do they just keep paying no matter what the cost, or do you reach a maximum out of pocket or a maximum benefit type of thing?
Well, the features in fact resemble, what do they resemble? They resemble in a way unemployment insurance, where you know you'll often have an elimination period, so that if you want to lower the cost for unemployment insurance, many of our listeners will know that you can choose to have it not kick in for several months. And there are other types of health insurance that have that provision. Mm-hmm. And it does significantly reduce it. So you calculate as a holder, look, in any case, I can pay for the first 2 or 3 months. And to the insurer, it tells them that anything small and that's not significant, you're not going to do because it's going to cost you personally a significant amount. So it kind of discourages anything but a bona fide claim. So in this case, you can do the same thing. You can get an elimination period in which you won't have coverage during the first 2, 3, or more months. That is a way in which you can reduce the cost. Another is you choose the amount of coverage you want per day. Now, in any case, you've got to choose a number that's going to be adjusted for inflation. And for these policies to meet the category of being qualified under the different states, and Missouri is one of those states where you get special benefits if you've bought something that the state wants to encourage you to buy these policies. So if you've bought them and it turns out that, for example, because of a policy, you've saved yourself or saved the state long-term care costs after your death of, choose a number, $20,000, then it means that that's $20,000 that there's no asset recovery on. Mm. So I'm introducing a term here that I hope the people listening have some idea what that's about. It relates to the fact that now states go and collect from your estate when you die for the amount of any benefits you received. And you can avoid that if you have what's called a qualified policy. And Missouri has signed on to that, these partnership policies, and as are a number of other states. So the advantage is for the insurance company is they get this endorsement sort of, and they end up, of course, selling a whole lot more policies. But in order to get that endorsement to be qualified, they have to have certain characteristics to every one of these policies. And among those characteristics is that they've got to give an inflation adjustment. Mm-hmm. So if you sign on for $150 a month, for example, benefit now, and I think the average of policies across the board is, according to a study published somewhere, it may have been ARP, was $160
a day. Mm-hmm.
So $160 a day. Well, that's not helpful if there's been significant inflation. And I probably don't have to remind our listeners, because our listeners, for the most part, are older listeners. They remember a day when there was inflation. Mm-hmm. Now, my daughters, you know, they think such a thing was kind of like the ice age. It passed.
Never to be seen again.
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of people today have never seen a heavy inflation period in the United States.
That's true.
They've not known it.
They keep talking about it. But
yeah, so those of us who've lived long enough know that given enough time, you know, there's going to be inflation. And so you need to consider this when you're buying your long-term care policies, because those who are choosing to buy it in their 50s, then there's a good chance they'll be calling on it maybe in 30 years. Mm-hmm. Don't underestimate your lifespan. And I encourage people to recognize that things are happening every day that can significantly increase your lifespan. Don't spend and live on the assumption that you're going to be gone at the 73.2 years that, at least recently, that was the average lifespan.
Well, and I know people that do that. I have had somebody say to me, well, I may not be around very much longer. I may as well spend it now. And I was like, you're 58. Holy smokes. I hope you live a little longer than that. You know.
Yeah. And there's a line from a movie Burt Reynolds was in. He was one of these aging gangsters. Uh-huh. Some of you may have seen this. And they're trying to survive in Miami. And you know, their era's long past. And so his colleague, who's kind of been his follower for many years in the old days, and said, "Boss, you promised it. You said to us that we're going to always live rich and comfortable the rest of our lives." And his point was, he said, "Well, I didn't expect us to live this long." And so some people, you know, they're planning and living and spending with the assumption that they're not going to make it, you know, beyond, say, the mid-70s or whatever the number is in their head. Mm-hmm. And the reality is it may turn out that they live a couple decades longer. It's nice to have surprises like that. Mm-hmm. But you want to be prepared for the surprise mm-hmm. in that way. So when you're thinking about long-term care insurance, you need to recognize that you've got to make a decision of, number one, be sure that it's a qualified policy. So it's going to have these core ingredients that you want to have, these common denominators that are consumer friendly. Probably the most, quite frankly, is the assurance that you have a certain amount of coverage that's adjusted for inflation. But the other thing to think about is, you know, what sort of period of time do you want to cover? I mean, on the one hand, we know that there's a 48% chance that you'll spend a year to a year and a half at the most mm-hmm. in a long-term care facility. So do you want to plan on paying for coverage for that period of time, or do you want to pay for coverage for 3 years? Now, as I recall, the qualified plans, and I haven't looked at them in a while, I think they're a minimum of 3 years.
That could be. Some of them I know have waiting periods, and then they pay. Some I've seen as a maximum of 3 years.
Yeah. So 3 years is a common number that's been used throughout the industry for some time now. And so if you have a qualified plan, then I'm pretty sure you'll find that it's at least 3 years.
Right.
But then the five-year period is an option on most plans. And some plans, incidentally, just go an unlimited amount. You can find those. Those of you who are completely risk-averse and you're willing to pay for that sort of assurance, you can find it. You can buy policies that don't have a ceiling. Now, the good news is if you're buying policies today, you can buy them with more confidence than those in the 90s could. Just because there are, you know, you'll read in the newspapers about I think Genworth is one of these companies, that there are several fairly large companies that may, in fact, end up going under. I don't know about Genworth, whether they'll go under, but I know that there are a number of these companies that have their concerns about the impact of their pricing. So just because you're seeing that, don't assume that that's going to apply to your companies. The companies now know a lot more. I mean, they can see further on the horizon, and their pricing is going to be much better. So I think you can more confidently buy policies now. You have a much larger range of choice. But you still have to be prepared to pay significantly. And those of you who are starting in your 60s, then that number is going to be significantly higher. And there's a chance you won't qualify because of some pre-existing condition. I don't see those who can afford it. I think it probably makes sense to start buying in your 50s. But the reason I qualify and say I think is that it's not a slam dunk. I mean, if you do the math and you decide that you're going to wait till you're 60, you can calculate how much money you would have saved during that period of time, and it's significant. And then when you're 60, you're going to know a lot more. You're going to know more about what costs are. The insurer is going to know a lot more, and it could be that costs go down. I mean, that's a very foreseeable outcome, believe it or not, because this is such a hot issue in Washington. Hmm. And occasionally what happens is that, you know, there is some radical solution provided, and I'm not suggesting nationalized care, but I'm suggesting a radical solution of some sort, whether it's in the private sector or not, that could, in fact, mean that, not that costs, in fact, maybe I shouldn't say go down, but they end up increasing at a much lower rate. Hmm. That is foreseeable. I don't think we should always think that we live in a world in which the cost of health care is going to always, you know, like a natural law, be double digits every year. I don't think that has to be the case.
Yeah, and there's certainly a lot of talk about it as the population ages and the voting bloc ages. Then Washington seems to take a little bit more notice.
It does. And you know, I prefer private sector solutions.
Right.
But I think wherever it comes from, I think it may, in fact, mean that we don't forever have spiraling healthcare costs.
So a question I have, too, and I've seen some information on this, is instead of a long-term care policy, some people are recommending getting more of a whole life policy that lets you draw from for long-term care. Do you know much about that, or is that a good option to consider?
Well, keep in mind, I say this to the consumer and to our clients, keep in mind that, you know, nothing is going to come free. So it doesn't mean that everything balances out perfectly when you consider the costs and benefits of various products. Not that they come out perfectly, but there's going to be some proportionality. And here's what I mean is, for example, when you're choosing between, on the one hand, a policy that is going to give you simply whole life and you have the ability to withdraw it, as you know, people who have whole life policies, there's a balance in there that they can they can borrow. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially paid from the proceeds. That option exists now. Mm-hmm. And they can take that money and go and buy something. Alternatively, they can buy this new product that has built into the product the anticipation that you'll take that and use perhaps some portion of it or convert it to long-term care. And that whatever you don't use from your whole life policy will be available to you in cash. Just remember that the same people are doing the arithmetic on these two products. And so that by, that means that they've calculated what the costs are in each direction. So some people think that when they hear about one product, they think it's going to just be on its face just radically better. But it can't be almost because the math has to be very similar to the other product.
Right.
So I don't want to confuse people in answering this question, but I want them to think more critically about new features and products. It's not that it's a bad idea, but I don't want them to think that it's this total gain without a net gain.
Right.
And that often that net is a lot less than they might otherwise have thought.
And really look at your unique situation and your unique circumstances and then kind of look at which option's going to work best for you. It seems like that's, to me, that's the best approach.
Yeah, and I agree. And remember that there are no free lunches in town. Mm-hmm. And that means that if they're giving you this new feature, you have to weigh that against what would be the options if you kept what you have now and used it perhaps in a different way. Or simply kept what you have now and went out and bought the other product. Do that math. So in other words, if you already own a whole life policy, and I'm not assuming you're going out to buy a whole life policy for this purpose, that would even raise more concerns, and I would suggest more deliberation. But let's assume you already have a whole life policy. If you already have a whole life policy, then you need to consider as one of your options that you went out and independently bought this product you're considering. Put that in as door number one, see what that total cost is, and then look at the conversion option.
Right. And try and figure out really what's going to be best for you. Now, the whole life policies will cost more initially, right? I mean, according to what I'm looking at.
Of course, yeah.
You know, instead of the $3,700, it might be $13,000. So you've got, that's what's on this website, looking at the prices for the different policies. So similar benefits, but the question is what's going to really serve your purposes best?
That's right. And be sure and do all the math of all the components and compare it. And then sometimes one will gain a lead, incidentally, especially when you consider your particular circumstances. But don't naively think that something's been added and that it's, you know, just far and away dramatically better for you financially than the other product.
Joe, we're kind of coming up to the end of our program. We've got just a couple of minutes left. Anything left that you want to share with us really quickly today? We love getting listener comments and questions, so feel free to give us a call or check out the website at eldercarelaw.com. And Joe, you want to close us out today?
Well, it's been a good discussion. I mean, I kind of like it when people call in because it introduces topics and subjects that we wouldn't otherwise go to. So let's encourage people to continue doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And we will continue to talk about a lot this issue of long-term care and, of course, how do you pay for it, policies, planning, trust, etc. Until then, we look forward to next week. This has been Elder Talk. Take care.
You've been listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. That's eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.